The following Bible study is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
So last time we left off, wasn't it finishing the fifth and sixth trumpets, wasn't it?
And we went through chapters 8 and 9.
Yeah, 9. Let's go back to, let's move over there, because where we ended was with the locust plague and 5 months of torment on mankind, and then there was a military action in which their armies were loosed and they killed a third of mankind. And, you know, normally those things would bring people, you would think, to see a third of mankind killed, to see the supernatural demonic locusts, as it were, to see them do this damage and torment men so they wanted to die, you'd think that would bring people to think a little bit and perhaps bring them to repentance. But that's not the case here in Revelation 9 and verse 20, for example. And the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues, yet they repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. Neither repented they of their murders or their sorceries nor their fornication nor their thefts. And we see all of that going on right now today in our civil society, but we see all the rest of it going on in the religious community as they have their religious relics and their various crosses and all of their emblems and so on that are made of wood and metal and things like that. They're still going to worship the way they want and not take anything from God. So tonight we begin the 6 month of Elul, I think is the way it's pronounced, Elul. And we're going to go into Revelation chapter 10. And Revelation 10 is an inset chapter, so it stops the flow of events. Where it's no longer talking about the trumpet plagues, and it moves on to something entirely different. And it's the first of several insets that go on. For instance, chapter 12 talks about the history of the church and so on. 11 talks about the two witnesses. So it stops here. It's not gotten to the seventh trump yet. And so it stops and it sort of says, wait a minute, let me fill you in on some other stuff. And that's what's going on here. And so in chapter 10 and verse 1, I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head. And his face is as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire. Revelation 5, if you will. You know, in reading and preparing for the Bible study tonight, I was surprised how many scholars actually think that this angel is Christ himself. And what he has said here is that he saw another mighty angel. Well, he's just talking about another angel besides himself and showing that he is in fact an angel. But again, when he's talking about another angel, what one was he talking about? Revelation 5 and verse 2, and I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the book and to loose the seals thereof. And so that's the other angel I think he's talking about here. And the other thing is that back to Revelation 10. So this angel that he sees is like the other angel that was a strong angel that he saw, and it was not Christ. And so in Revelation 10, let's skip over to verse 5, and the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven, and he swore by him that lived forever and ever, who created heaven and the things therein are, and the earth and the things that therein are, and the sea and the things which are therein, and that there should be no time longer. And so you see what this angel is actually praising, you know, Christ, and swearing to him. And so he can't possibly be swearing to himself. You know, it's not Christ, even as some scholars may say that. And so I think that's an important point, at least, for those studying this. And Revelation 11 for a minute, because when Christ is spoken of in the book of Revelation, as far as I remember, it's almost always clear who is being spoken of here. And Revelation 11:15 is, I think, a good example of that, where it says, "And the seventh angel sounded, and there were great voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever." But you see, he's not trying to hide something, like an angel is actually something else. That's all I'm trying to get at here. So back to Revelation 10. The angel is not Christ. It is another very powerful angel. And it's interesting, though, how he is shown and why they think that this angel could be Christ, because if you notice, he's clothed with a cloud, he has a rainbow upon his head, which is sort of giving you images of the throne in heaven. His face is like the sun, and of course it says that about Christ, doesn't it? It shines in its full strength if you look in his face. And his feet are like pillars of fire. And so you see this imagery, and I think the imagery is there not because he is Christ, but he's a reflection of Christ, that I think that he's a representative of Christ. And I think he is a strong angel, in other words, one that would stand at the throne and be there. Remember Gabriel, when he was talking to John the Baptist's father, he says, "I'm Gabriel, and I stand before the throne of Almighty God." You kind of get a sense of the feel of the pride that he has of the position that he's allowed to have. Well, I'm just saying that I think this, what we see, is angelic beings that are proclamation beings. In other words, they bring messages from God to mankind. And I think in particular there are, of course, armies of angels that are controlled and under the authority of Michael. But there are angels that are in the very presence of God all the time, and I think that these angels are powerful angels and probably reflect the beauty, the majesty, and the strength of Christ. And I think that's what this angel is all about. And he stands on both the land and on the sea, Revelation 10, verse 2. "And he had in his hand a little book open, and he set his right foot upon the sea and his left foot upon the earth." And, you know, one thing I'd like to make clear in that is that what you see here is an angel that is showing John a little book. And many times you see angels performing different acts, miraculous acts, in the book of Revelation. But that isn't the case here. This is not something that's going to happen in the future. The angel is coming here to show him a book. And the things that are in this book are things that are going to happen in the future. And the other thing is that this was written in a time when they had books with binding and things like that. In the time when John actually saw this vision, they did not have books. What he saw was a small scroll. It was unrolled, and he could actually read it from where he was. And so anyway, it's not sealed. He can see what's on it. He can read what's on it. And he's told, don't write down the message in verse 3 and 4. "And he cried with a loud voice as a lion roars. And when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voice. And when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, and write them not." And this kind of reminds me of the example that we have in Daniel 12. Let's go over there and take a look for a minute at Daniel 12. You remember, this is another case when an angel is speaking to Daniel. Daniel 12, verse 7. "And I heard a man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand up to heaven, and swear by him that lives forever, that it shall be for a time, times and a half, when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, and then all these things shall be finished. And I heard, but I understood not. And I said, O my Lord, what shall the end of these things be? And he said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end. And I think you can't help but notice it, lifting the hands up and swearing to God. And it's like the same thing that we're seeing. And then also there was a sealing that took place with Daniel here. And it's interesting that the angel revealed to him that a beast would come down to the Middle East. He revealed to him that this beast would cut off the sacrifices. He revealed to him that he would set up an abomination of desolation. And he gave him that broad outline, but he didn't give him the details. He said those things are sealed until the end. But the book of Revelation is written for the people at the end. It's written about the end. And the book of Revelation fills in those other details that Daniel had sealed. And, you know, you can look at this book of Revelation and you see there's these different sections, and part of it has church history and part of it has, you know, the eras. Others, it has just the church history. It has the beast history. It has the horrors history written in there. And it has all these different things. And this is an inset that talks about seven thunders. And I think that it's very easy, interesting to speculate on this, that the angel doesn't let him write what he hears or what he sees in this small roll or scroll. And I don't think that this means that we can't find evidence in the scriptures to give us an idea of what this might be. But I want to say again, it's sealed. So the details we can't know. We might be able to see some scriptures that would point to something to give us evidence that we could get an idea of what these thunders are. But the details of their message, we are never going to find out probably until much later or perhaps when they actually happen. So all I can do is actually speculate, but I think we can do it with some wisdom, some understanding. That I remember years ago there was a sermon given on this, and the minister said that the seven thunders were the messages from the seven church eras. But when you think about it, I don't see how that could be on a little scroll or a little roll. I don't think you could contain that. For instance, we're on television here in Billings and in some other places, and we go through each time. We'll go through like the red horse, the white horse, the black horse, the pale horse. We'll go through what's happening to America. We'll go through different things that are scriptural that could fill many books. Just from what we do. And here's the Church of God down through all the eras preaching this the gospel to the world for a witness. And you see that to me it would be impossible to contain that on something he could see as a scroll that he's holding in his hand that's open, and he's able to hear what they're saying and in a short time. So anyway, I want to speculate a little bit about this. And first of all, I want to mention that that the angel has, let's go to Revelation 11, has his feet on both the land and on the sea. And I think there's a symbolic meaning to this. And that is that what takes place with these seven thunders is going to affect the whole world. You know, the other thing is that we know that what the message is regarding the seven thunders is regarding things that are going to happen on the earth. On the earth. It's not something that is heavenly or anything like that. And so it says that the seven thunders uttered their voices. And this is a Greek expression, la leo phoni. And I probably pronounced it wrong, but it means to talk, preach, or speak with a language, those words do. And the origin of the word voices, when he said that he heard the voices, also helps us understand, I think, because it means disclosing things to another by the spoken word. And so this was being told to him. It was being declared, and he heard it in a spoken language, and he could write it down, except he was told not to. So who proclaims these seven thunderous messages? I think is also important, but this is taking place before the seventh trumpet occurs. So if it's taking place on the earth, what time could it be taking place at? It would have to be taking place, whatever these seven thunders are, it would be taking place during the tribulation period. And from my point of view, who is proclaiming the truth of God during the tribulation? Revelation 11, verse 3, "And I'll give power," it says, "unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the whole earth. And if any man will hurt them," and I think this is an important clue here, "that fire proceeds out of their mouth and devours their enemies. And if any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. And these have power to shut the heaven that it rains not in the days of their prophecy. And they have power over the waters to turn them to blood and to smite the earth with plagues, all plagues, as often as they will." And so here are two individuals that are told that they're going to prophesy. They're going to be preaching and teaching for 1,260 days. That's the 3.5-year tribulation period. So my point is, look, the people that are God's people, the preachers and ministers and so on, are going to be in two places during this period of time. They're going to be probably in the place of safety for some. Others will be in the tribulation, and they'll be powerless to do much preaching in that case that would be worldwide in any sense at all. And so as Moses confronted Jannes and Jambres, then these two prophets are going to confront the beast and the false prophet. And God says he's going to supernaturally protect them. And so what he does is he gives them powers like those that were given to Moses and to Elijah. They'll be able to turn rivers into blood, it says. And the Elijah figure will be able to stop and start rain at will. And then fire proceeds from their mouth. And the word fire, by the way, if you look it up in Strong's, you can translate it lightning. And that makes sense. In other words, I wouldn't want people to think that fire was coming out of a human being's mouth and going and burning somebody up, but rather that in this case it would be lightning, and the term mouth can be translated language. In other words, that what they say, they call it down from heaven. They call fire down or lightning down. So the other point is that during a rainstorm, you're going to see lightning. Whenever you see lightning, what do you hear? You hear peals of thunder. And to me, this is the connection between the two witnesses and the seven thunders. It's found right here. The two witnesses are the only ones on the whole earth that are representing God during this time of the tribulation. They are the only ones. And they have power to stop and start the rain, and they have power to call lightning down. It reminds me of Malachi. Let's go over there from Malachi 4. Just before Matthew, Malachi 4, and it just reminds me of the Elijah that is to come. In other words, I know people talk about, some think Mr. Armstrong was the Elijah to come, but the Elijah to come actually has the power to do what the original Elijah was able to do, and that's to start and stop the rain at will, to call fire down from heaven. So in Malachi 4 and verse 4, it says, "Remember you the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. And some have called said that should be utter destruction. So before the, you know, the vile plagues were poured out, even after the seventh trump, before all this happens, there's going to be an Elijah figure that is going to prophesy to the earth, and he's going to join the people back to the fathers. And it doesn't mean like the children to our fathers, like, you know, helping bind families together. It's really talking about the Ten Commandments. And he's talking about to the fathers, meaning Abraham, Moses, you know, Jacob, those people that kept God's Ten Commandments. That's what he's, the whole issue is about here. And that's what Elijah is going to do, is he's going to turn them back to the fathers, our fathers, all of us who are the children, especially those remnants of the children of Israel. And so, anyway, those that advocated the commandments is the point. So, this final Elijah is going to have powers like the original one. Let's go to 1 Kings 18. 1 Kings 18. And there's, you know, interesting stories all through these chapters that I think serve as interesting illustrations to us and examples for us to learn from them. So everybody, I think, remembers the case of the original Elijah, and where he called for the 400 prophets of Baal to come, and they would have a contest to see who was the true God. And so the 400 prophets of Baal are dancing, they're praying to their God, and they're cutting themselves, which is, was part of their religious practice, and causing blood to come out. And you know, Elijah's mocking him, and he's saying, well, maybe he's asleep, pray a little louder, you know, maybe he's on the toilet, you know. And he's mocking these guys. They all day long, they're doing this. No fire comes down for them. But Elijah just says a simple prayer, and the fire comes down and burns up the sacrifice, the offering that was there. Everybody's familiar with that, I think. In chapter 18, verse 37, chapter 18, verse 37. Hear me, O Lord, he prays. Hear me, that this people may know that you are the Lord God, and that you've turned their hearts back again. And then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. The people saw it. They fell on their faces and said, the Lord, he's God. The Lord, he is God. And then he ordered them to kill all the prophets and so on. So here is a time and that when they were having a severe famine, and he proves who God is, and then he tells Ahab, you know, the king, he says, it will rain. And so he tells Ahab, you better get going, because, you know, you won't be able to finish traveling because of the rain. And then it started a downpour because he had called for the rain. So the first Elijah could cause it to not rain, then he could cause it to rain. He could call fire down from heaven. And that's what I think the end time, what we see, the end time witnesses are going to have that same power. And so I suggest that one of those men represents a Elijah figure, and the other a Moses figure. So anyway, after Ahab died, 2 Kings, if you will, 2 Kings 1, after Ahab died, the next king that took over was, what's his name, Uzziah. Anyway, he was king of Samaria at the time, and the northern area there. And we get another picture of this here. he fell through the lattice and was severely injured, and he was on his bed, and he sent to the God of Baal and wanted to know if, you know, if he could be healed or not. And what happened was he sent these men out, and then he sent Elijah out to meet the men, and he said to Elijah, tell him, you know, isn't there a God? Why are you going to Baal? Isn't there a God in Israel? Why don't you call on me? You know, why are you going to some other God? And so he tells these guys, and they go back and they tell the king, well, we, you know, saw Elijah, who Ahab wanted to kill, actually. And we saw him, and here's what he said. And then he says, I tell you what, I mean, he sends 50 men out, and he sends them out actually three times. We won't see the third time, because the third time the guy goes, I don't want any problems with you, Elijah, you know. But it's interesting, and 1 Kings here, I'm sorry, 2 Kings 1 and 9, fascinating story. And so the king sent unto him a captain of 50, and his 50. And so we got 51 people here. And he went up to him, and behold, he sat on the top of a hill and spoke unto him, you man of God, the king has said, come down. Come on down. He wants to get him, you know. And Elijah answered, and he said to the captain of the 50, if I be a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50. And there came down fire from heaven and consumed him and his 50. Again, also he sent unto him another captain of 50 and his of 50 and his 50. And he answered and said unto him, O man of God, thus has the king said, come down quickly. And Elijah answered and said unto him, if I'm a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50. And the fire of God came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. Now, do you begin to make a connection with the two witnesses, that if anyone attacks them or tries to hurt them, they have the power to call fire down from heaven, and that they are an Elijah figure, and that's what Elijah did? And so I think it starts looking more clear, and I know it, and I want to repeat it. It's speculation because it's sealed. We can't know every detail, but look at some of this evidence here. He could do all those things, or he will do, one will do, all those things that the original Elijah could do. And in this context, I want us to consider something that's in more fully explained perhaps in the book Evidence for Eras, Mark. Let's go to Mark and chapter 3. Mark and chapter 3, because there's an unusual incident, I would say. Mark 3. That takes place here. Because Christ, as you remember, took the 12 up into a mountain, and there he ordained them apostles. Up to this time, they were merely disciples, but now he ordains them as actually apostles with power. And there was concurrent to this a small detail that occurred that I think is really fascinating and provides another clue to me to who or what the seven thunders are. And he gave a unique surname to a couple of the apostles. So in verse 14 of chapter 3, and he ordained the 12 that they should be with him, and that he might send them forth to preach, and to have power to heal the sick, sicknesses, and cast out the devils. And Simon, he surnamed Peter, as we remember, and James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, he surnamed them Boanerges, which is or means the sons of thunder. And the question I have then is, why would he call them, these two men, sons of thunder? Well, back to Luke 9 here. Let's move back a little bit to Luke 9. And it gives the explanation of why he, I believe it gives the explanation, at least, of why he called them by this term. So remember that Christ was on his way to Jerusalem, and the Jews were hated by the Samaritans. There was a huge animosity between both of them. And so the Jews, they would actually go out of their way miles and miles to not pass through Samaria. But Christ wasn't like that. He had no such hostility, I understand. Yeah. And anyway, he walked the straight, short, natural path that a person would take to get down to Jerusalem, and he went through Samaria. And when he did, he went through a town, and the people there rejected him. They said that they didn't want him to stay there. You know, so go someplace else, find another place. You know, just like the black people were treated sometimes in the South at times. So anyway, when the two disciples, these two particular disciples, saw this, Luke 9 and verse 54, they had something interesting to say. And when the disciples James and John saw this, they said, "Lord, will you that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, even like Elijah did?" And he turned and rebuked him and said, "You don't know what manner of spirit you are." But the two disciples wanted to call down fire from heaven, and they wanted to act like the prophet Elijah. And I think it's for this reason that Christ did not call them sons of fire. He didn't call them sons of Elijah, but he called them sons of thunder. And I think that there wasn't any word that Christ just spoke with, you know, without meaning. In other words, there's a purpose to everything he said and a reason for what he said. And I think he called them sons of thunder because they wanted to call fire down from heaven. And I think it probably reminded Christ of the two witnesses and what they'll be able to do, back to Revelation 10. So is it possible, I ask, is it possible that heaven, those in heaven, the angels and so on, do they have a term like that, that could be almost affectionate term? You know, like Christ would call these men in an affectionate way. It wasn't a lamb blast. It wasn't cutting them down. But it was an affectionate term, sons of thunder, you know. Is it possible that in heaven there is a term for the two witnesses? Is it that they call them the sons of thunder? It's a possibility, but it sure, you know, there's again a connection. Sons of thunder, two men wanting to call fire down from heaven, and two men who will call fire down from heaven in the future. So, you know, I think it's possible when it's talking about sons of thunder, it's a reference to these two witnesses, you know, because if they start to call rain down from heaven, there's going to be peals of thunder that are going to accompany it. If they're attacked, thunder's probably going to be heard if they call lightning down. And when we have lightning out here, boy, we had a nice storm the other day that tore all our screens up, you know. And boy, when that lightning hits and you just hear this enormous rumble, and it makes you think of what when you hear that rumble? I mean, if you're anything like me, I always think of the power of God. I always do when I hear that rumble. And I think there's a connection there and a reason why it's the way it is. So anyway, these guys, the two witnesses, preach against the beast and the false prophet. And when they are attacked, or if they are attacked, is it possible that this happens seven times, that they're preaching against the false prophet, just like we see Elijah preaching against the Baal worshipers? And when this happens, are they attacked? Well, of course they're going to be attacked. And then what are they going to do? They're going to call fire down from heaven. And it's just the same pattern that we see. And God generally works with patterns, but it's the same pattern we see with Elijah in the past. So if the details of what they said were recorded, here's what I think it would happen. I think it would have an enormous effect. If the details saying that the false prophet is wrong, that that religion is wrong, and saying specifics about it, and saying that the beast is wrong, and here's what he's doing, and this is wrong. If that were written down, then people at the end of the age would know exactly they're wrong. They would know. The Bible would tell them the details, and they would know the beast and false prophet are wrong. But what he's done is he's kept the details secret, sealed. And he's done that, I believe, because he wants people at the end to act not out of fear, not out of coercion, but he wants them to act out of what's in their heart, not what's written here that would scare them into change, not following them. And that's kind of the way he works. He doesn't force his religion on people. And we'll see that as we go on here. One of the things that I think is important to bring out is that these thunders don't happen all at once. If they did, they would be unintelligible and they would not be able to be written down. And he was going to write them down. He heard it. He was going to write them down. And so they had to happen sequentially. And so I think it's this happens, they're threatened, they call down fire. This happens, they're threatened, they call down fire. This happens, and each time there's enormous, not probably like the thunder that scared the daylights out of me the other day, but even worse, even more frightening, even more awesome than anything that we have seen before. So, how could he tell that there were seven thunders? You know, how could he tell it unless each one was separately told? And it was short. It wasn't a long statement. It was something short, something he could read that was open to him. And he was ordered not to do it. And this happens before the seventh trump, back here to Revelation 10, and verse 7. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he has declared to his servants, the prophets. So again, you can see that this is taking place before the resurrection ever happens. And so it is taking place during that time period we call the tribulation. And this seventh trump, it says, now the seventh trump happens, and the mystery of God is now understood, it's now revealed, it's no longer a mystery. But that doesn't mean it's the end of God's plan with the seventh trump. And many in the past, I think, thought that the mystery is that man's destiny is to be no less than the son or daughter of God, that we're going to be a part of his family. That's been a mystery that's been held back from the world from before the earth was created. That was kept secret and not told. And it's only us who have the Spirit of God and some who have heard us, as a book we just recently read, makes that claim that this is God's secret. But the point is that God's plan continues on from there. There's a marriage supper. There is a marriage between God's people and Jesus Christ himself. Satan is then put away. There are seven vile plagues that are poured out that are way more devastating, not a third. I think the thirds are related to the fact that a third of the angels. I think it's a mocking, you know, Satan's destructive power on the earth. And so you see a third of everything, third of the trees, third of the water, third of this, third of the men are killed. When those vials are poured out, it's big time. It's devastation like the world's never seen before. That's why the seventh trump is called a woe. And yet the seventh trump is a resurrection. We've always kind of celebrated that, you know. But the seventh trump is one of the third woe. And the reason it's a woe is because it is so frighteningly devastating what is going to happen here. And so there's this then second resurrection after 1,000 years. Then there is a judgment, a white throne judgment. There is the lake of fire, and then there is the new heavens and new earth, and then there is the next plan, stage two of the plan, once he gets everybody on the same page. Now we can do what he originally wanted to do from the beginning. And so this doesn't end God's plan. This isn't what we are looking to, and this isn't our grand hope is that seventh trump. Yes, it's a hope, and yes, it's wonderful, but what we really should look to is when we can all finally be together as the family of God, and the new Jerusalem is on the earth, that is a new earth, and there's a new heavens, and we will have an entirely new plan that God has not begun to reveal to us yet, because we could never, ever understand it until we are like He is. And so that's what I think we should be looking forward to. Revelation 10 and verse 8. And the voice which I heard from heaven spoke unto me again and said, go and take the little book which is open, or roll or scroll, in the hand of the angel which stands upon the sea. And I went unto the angel and said unto him, give me the little book. And he said to me, take it and eat it up, and it shall make your belly bitter, and it shall be in your mouth sweet as honey. And so God says, take the little book. And then he goes up to the angel and he says, give me the little book. And he says, take the little book. And I think there's a lesson in this, and that is that God doesn't want to just spoon feed us and just hand us anything we want. I think he's going, you know, if you want what I've got, if you want my way, take it. Understand? Take it. Go after it. And I think that's part of what we could get from this point here. So anyway, to me, there's another point here. And he took the little book out of the angel's hand and ate it up. And it was in his mouth sweet as honey. And as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. And this kind of reminds me of Ezekiel, if you will, Ezekiel 3. Something I remember back there and I wanted to include. But there's several, if you look in the Psalms, there's several places where it talks about God's word being sweet as honey. I mean, over and over it actually says this. But he says here, moreover, he said unto me in verse 1, chapter 3 of Ezekiel, son of man, eat what you find, eat this roll, and go speak to the house of Israel. And so I opened my mouth, and he caused me to eat the roll. And I want to make a comment that when I looked it up, caused me is not in there, because it looks like forced. And it goes against my point I want to make. It looks like he's causing him or forcing him to eat it, but that word doesn't actually exist in the original. He said to me, son of man, cause thy belly to eat. Fill your bowels with this roll that I gave you. And then I did eat it, and it was in my mouth as sweet as honey. And then he said, go to the house of Israel and speak my words to them. And so the point is that, you know, we read God's word, and I think putting these pieces together like pieces of a puzzle, as he tells us to do, you know, is sweet. It's actually, you know, really enjoyable. And God's truth is something beautiful. And if you can see the world we're in now, the crime, the drugs, the corruption in government, those things that are happening, we see in the news every day. When you read God's word about what we have to look forward to, or the world has to look forward to in the millennial reign, and what we have to look forward to even after that, as we become rulers and officers and the wife of Christ and administer the government of God through the rest of all eternity. You know, this is all sweet, isn't it? And one of the things I think that this tells us here in Ezekiel is that we should do that, because we're going to be kings and priests. You know, we're not just, you know, it's not just the prophets or these great men of God and just, we're just nothings. No, we're going to be right there with them, you know. And so our job is the same as theirs, to really fill ourselves. You understand what he's saying to Ezekiel here? Is he's saying, eat my words, eat my way, make it a part of you, and so you can go and preach. You can just preach from your heart. You know, it'll be a part of you. And what does he tell us? That he wants his word and his commandments and his law and his way of life to be written in our hearts and minds. It's the same thing. And we do that by living it over and over again. As we strive to live his way, it's like engraving. You know what I mean? You can't just take something and engrave it with one strike. You know, you can't do that. You have to take a chisel and go over it and over it and over it and over it, don't you? And that's what we do. we strive to live God's way, and it etches His law into our mind, and it's written there in our mind. So, Revelation 10, and the last verse there, Revelation 10, and He said to me, "You must prophesy again before many people, and nations, and tongues, and kings." After 18 months of imprisonment in Patmos, John was released, and he pastored, as you probably know, the seven churches that are mentioned in Revelation 2 and 3, but he also pastored four other churches that were on that mail route. Plus, I'm sure there are cases where he had other churches. You remember when in 3 John it talks about Diotrephes? You know, I don't know what church that was, but it was another church that was being corrupted there, and John was over it. So John was over these churches in a foreign territory, in a foreign land. But not only that, the book of Revelation has been translated way over 2,000 times, different languages. Can you imagine that? So his preaching is still going out. And there weren't any of the kings of England that didn't have copies of this in their desk. There isn't any of the kings down in Germany that didn't have copies. You know, it went everywhere, all over, and there's even 50 places where they don't have a written language. They've translated this book in 50 of those places, audio for those people. So his word has gone out to many peoples and many tongues and many kings all throughout the land. And it continues to go out and will go out until the very end, until the beast has the power to stamp out the power of the holy people. So anyway, my point is that this book that we're going through is of enormous significance. And I hope that we've made some connections tonight that will help people understand, as time goes on, the relationship here, and who these two witnesses are and what their responsibilities are, and respect them and respect what God is doing, and really be grateful for the understanding that we do have and that we've been allowed to have, and to be grateful for this calling that gives us the ability to look into this book and to put the pieces of the puzzle together and make sense of it. So next time, chapter 11, the two witnesses and the work that they're going to do.